This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done and endured incredible things for the sake of our freedom. We want to make sure that our veterans know how much we appreciate it. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. Sometimes we're even inspired by their stories. And the story we're going to hear today is a story of survival. 94-year-old Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico, our guest. For 3.5 of those 94 years, he was a prisoner of war in the Pacific Theater. And he has quite a story to tell. We're going to hear it over the next hour. Let's start out early on, though. You did not grow up initially in New Mexico, Bill. You were from Illinois, farm town?
I was near Decatur, Illinois. Well, we had moved to Decatur by the time before we'd left and came to New Mexico, for New Mexico was one of the top places to go if you had tuberculosis. My mother had tuberculosis. I've been through all the schools here. I've graduated engineering degree from the University of New Mexico thanks to the GI Bill. After I came back from overseas.
And it was quite a task to make it home from overseas and to survive everything you went through. So you moved here to Albuquerque when you were 8 years old, finished high school here, were even in college. And I guess it was during those years that you decided to join the National Guard?
I carried newspapers when I was in junior high school, and I was able to buy a Model A Roadster.
Ooh.
For $75. That's pretty darn cheap, I'll tell you. Anyway, when I got to college, well, I didn't have any money for gasoline and miscellaneous expenses, going to a restaurant and so on. So I joined the National Guard. At that time, it was 111th Cavalry. It was a state organization. It had been that way since the time of Roosevelt and the Cuban crisis. I would go once a month, I guess it was, and we'd have a drill downtown in the armory, and then we'd get $19 a month. And that was that wasn't bad money, but it wasn't very much, but it helped. And of course, I was in the guard when they finally decided, well, we had a fracas overseas, and we've got to have some help. So they picked on the New Mexico National Guard and said, go down to Fort Bliss and train. So we did.
But before we move on, I'm curious, because you spent, I guess, from age 8, and that would have been to about age 20, even 21, here in Albuquerque. I know what it's like now. I've gotten a taste of it. What was it like back then? Was it a lot different? I know it didn't have as many people. But what were the kinds of things you really enjoyed about Albuquerque back then?
The skiing in the wintertime. We'd have pretty good snows up on the mountains, and we'd go fishing in the summertime. We never did have too much water, but we did have enough water to come down from Colorado and fill up some of our lakes. And it was just a clean town of about a 20,000 population.
20,000?
20,000 people when we came.
A lot more than that now.
Yeah. They had a streetcar going down the main street downtown, but they had discontinued that before we got there. And, of course, we all went to the moving picture shows and saw all of the Errol Flynn and all the favorite movie actors, and it was fun. We enjoyed it.
There wasn't anything called the Pit back then, was there?
No, there was not. No. We belonged to what they called the Border Conference, and it was a series of teams from Arizona, Arizona State, Utah, UNM, the Aggies. No, let's see. No, I don't think the Aggies were in it. But there was it was a very competitive football, basketball, and baseball. We enjoyed that as well.
Were you ever involved in any of those sports?
I tried. One time it was before we went overseas. I said to myself, well, I've always loved football. I remember back in Decatur, Illinois, we lived right across the street from a grade school that had a real nice lawn, and the high school would come and practice every day for football. So I've always loved football. One time I went out for football for the Lobos. It was spring football. They put me in. I weighed about 145 pounds, I do believe. I played defensive end for a couple scrimmages and so on and so forth. Finally, the coach put me head to head against Dutch Niemans, who was a border conference, all border conference fullback. He weighed 200 plus pounds, and he had the ball, and I was supposed to tackle him. Well, I said, the only way I can get him to come down is to hit him low. So I hit him, bent my head down low, and the darn fool, he kicked me in the head with his thigh on the top of the old leather helmet I had, and I was drunk for 2 hours. I said to myself, Bill, You want to die? You keep playing football. So I quit.
Little did you know what other perils and hazards you were going to face.
Yep.
The old days of Albuquerque, 20,000 people. Wow. So they send you to Fort Bliss. And I imagine before that, you'd had some ambitions, right? You're in engineering school at the University of New Mexico. What were you hoping to do with yourself?
Aeronautical engineer. I wanted to spend 2 years as my basic engineering at UNM and then go to the main airplane manufacturing in Washington, which is Boeing.
Uh-huh.
They had a school to put out the final engineering the last 2 years. That was my goal. Well, I didn't too good in the first couple of years, and then came the call for the National Guard, so I had to postpone it.
How did you feel about that at the time? Uncle Sam saying, head to Fort Bliss. Were you nervous that you might be in some dicey situations, or were you excited for an adventure?
Well, we kind of took it because they told us we had to. They'd been paying us for, I don't know, a couple of years, and so we felt obligated. And but we had no idea where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
And we never did find out until we got to the ocean and just kept going to the setting sun. Of course, you finally realize you're going west. And how far are you going? We did not know. We got as far as Hawaii, and I got off. I tried my hand at surfing on a surfboard, paddled out into the waves, and turned around, and here came a wave. Well, the wave went right on by, and I tried it again, and the wave went right on by. So I had to paddle all the way back to shore. I got a nice case of prickly heat in my back from the rest of the trip. I wasn't ready, cut out to be a surfer either.
Well, and little did you know that that little corner of the world would be under attack before too long. This was before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor when you were there.
Yes, it was. Anyway, got back on our ship. We had all of the first battalion of our 200th Coast Artillery anti-aircraft on this one boat. The President Pierce was the name of it. Came to within about a week of Manila. And here came a storm like we have never seen before. It was a typhoon, and it tossed our boat around like it was a feather. I remember looking over the side, looking down to the water level, and it was at least 40 feet below the bottom of the boat. I said, why didn't the boat roll off into that chasm? But we survived, and some of our equipment, our 4-inch guns, were scooting around on the deck, and some of the guys got out there and restrapped them down and saved them. We had them when we landed in Manila.
I imagine that was a pretty big eye-opener for you, because I imagine you never dealt much with the open sea at all, coming from New Mexico, and certainly not a typhoon from that. Were you scared? Were you wondering whether you'd survive it?
Of course we were scared. It was just unbelievable. We just had our fingers crossed that we'd never have to go through that again. Anyway, we landed in Manila. They moved us up to Fort Stotzenberg, which is adjacent to Clark Field, and we attended drill again, close quarter drill. We were very good at that, and it got so darn hot every day we'd go out and then come in at noon, and We'd have to strip off our khakis and put on a new fresh set. You'd have to crease the pants open to get your leg in them. They had starch in them.
Uh-huh.
And that's the way they treated the uniforms. And we drilled and practiced. And when the first day of war came, well, we were in the north runway of Clark Field. It's clear down at the end, and we were dug in. We had our 4 3-inch guns dug in, the M4 director, and the stereoscopic height finder. Incidentally, I was the chief of range section of the aiming, you might say, of the 4-inch guns, and that's the M4 director was the brains for the whole thing. Now, this is before radar.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we discovered that battery A had been issued radar, and after they hit us there, the first day of war, well, the second day, they three planes came in and they were flying low. The radar told us, we've got three boys coming in such and such 1,000 feet. So we matched pointers until we could see them. And then we went visual. They were coming right straight at us. So I turned in, I was on the M4 director. I entered a little correction on the M4 and shortened the target range and the guns going off. So the explosions would be in front of them. They'd have to fly through it. We got 2 out of 3. The best shooting we had during the whole dang war.
And if you hadn't made that adjustment, you might have gone 0 for 3.
That's right.
And for folks who don't understand what you're talking about, explain this apparatus. When you say the M4, what does that mean? And how does that determine how these guns are going to operate?
From Fort Bliss, I had been sent to Fort Monroe, Virginia, to the stereoscopic height finder school. Now, a height finder is a carryover of the range finders that ships use on the ships to determine how far the target is. When they fire their big 12-inch guns or whatever, they have to know how far that target is, if it's 1 mile or 3 miles or just what. And stereoscopic height finder vision is, everybody's got it. It's depth perception. Mm-hmm. And what you do is, you take a little cross that's in the height finder and hold it even with the target, and then you say, read. You have 4 men on the height finder. They send that information, which is the critical information of all for the third dimension of anti-aircraft fire, and send it to the M4 director. The M4 director is a box on a tripod, has 4 men around it, and it's about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet up on a tripod. It's the brains on how far we lead the target with our shot so we can hit the target.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically one of the basic things we learned there at Fort Bliss, of course.
And little did you know, you would only have a short time to operate those kind of weapons. I want to ask you, they pull you out of everything you're doing. They send you this training. Now they send you overseas. We don't have a war yet. I mean, the war's going in Europe, sure, but you don't, America is not at war. America hasn't been attacked. Was it starting to sink into you that they must know something's coming? If they're sending me halfway across the world, that something's about to happen? Did you have an inkling?
Yes, we had scuttlebutt, if anybody knows what that is. It's rumors, and unconfirmed, and somebody's thought or somebody's imagination, who knows what it is. But we live on scuttlebutt. We had rumors that Hawaii had been hit. Some of the guys said, yeah, well, we're going to fight them, but it'll take 6 weeks or so, and we'll clean their plow. Well, it didn't take any 6 weeks, and it took much longer, and it was everything we could do to survive. But the whole darn thing had to do with our forces in Washington, D.C., our brains resolving a conflict with Japan. And this had been going on for several years. We were sending scrap metal, selling scrap metal to Japan. Japan had ambitions. They had beaten the Russians at a naval conflict, and they were confident that they could get what they wanted. They needed oil. They needed steel. They needed knowledge. They'd sent their military men to the United States, and the United States taught them how to fight a war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no kidding. That's what happened at Pearl Harbor. Guess what? They used that same lecture to bomb Pearl Harbor. So we knew that things were going to change.
And a lot of people don't realize that war ensued simultaneously in the Philippines when it hit Pearl Harbor, that you guys were under attack basically the same day, right?
That's correct.
Clark Field was hit that same day, although...
It was December the 8th, but it was after the Asiatic Pacific line.
The international date line.
Right.
So it's December 8th in the Philippines, December 7th in Hawaii, but it's the same day you guys are hit.
Roughly 8 hours after Pearl Harbor was hit.
Well, we need to take a break, but we'll talk more about that when we come back. You've heard a lot about Pearl Harbor, but what about the first day of war in the Philippines? And what kind of conditions would Bill have to endure as supplies dwindled and the Japanese advanced? How did he avoid getting swept up on the Bataan Death March? We'll explore some of those questions when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.